This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With a rising sense of panic about rapid warming in the Arctic, even during this past polar winter, it's time to check in with an expert in the field, Dr. Mark Cerise. He is the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center and professor of geography at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mark has a new book coming out in April about the development of Arctic science. We'll get to that. Mark Cerise, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thanks. It's been a few years, but it's great to be back.
It has been a while. Back in 2012, we talked about the Arctic death spiral, and now I guess we're kind of living it. But let's catch up with a little fact-checking of claims that I've seen around the net. And first, is polar sea ice at a record low this winter of 2017-18?
Well, right now it's close. What we're having right now is a little bit of a growth of ice growth, very late spurt. So we're not sure where it's going to sit in the record books, but whatever ice we form right now is pretty much irrelevant because the growth season is over. Whatever grows is going to be really thin. So, you know, even if we don't break a record in the next few days, it's going to be close. But we're set up for another world to hurt this coming summer.
Now, is it accurate to say Arctic sea ice is declining at about a rate of 13% per decade?
Yeah, well, what you have to remember is that the rate of decline depends on the season. What you're talking about, 13% per decade, that's in September. That's at the sea ice minimum, and that number is correct. It's a pretty darn big number. Now, the sea ice is declining in all months, January, February, March, April, but it's biggest at the end of summer. And now the reason why it's smaller in the winter, in part, is because a lot of ice can grow even though it's very thin, right? So if you look at the trends in the sea ice extent, it's smaller in the winter, bigger in the summer. If you look at what's happening, say, in the sea ice volume, that is sort of the area times the thickness, it's on a more steady downward tick.
Was the North Pole above freezing in February, and would that be unusual?
Well, what we've seen is over at least the past three winters, these amazing heat waves over the Arctic Ocean. And we just got done with one kind of towards the end of February. And, yeah, we were looking at temperatures near the North Pole, basically at the melting point. That is not supposed to be happening. I mean, this is the Arctic, and it should be quite cold there at that time of year. It's the third winter in a row, at least, that we've seen this. Now, other parts of the Northern Hemisphere have been actually cold, right? So you get a very, very warm Arctic Ocean. But places over parts of Eurasia actually were kind of cold. Same thing over the Canadian Arctic Archipelago on that North American side. But this stuff we've seen going on over the Arctic Ocean, I've been looking at this kind of stuff for, since the early 1980s, and I've never seen anything like it.
Do you agree with the new science from Jennifer Francis and Judah Cohen pointing out the parallels between Arctic conditions and increased winter storms in places like New England or even northern China? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my view is that it's still a very controversial thing. It's probably one of the hottest topics out there, no pun intended, in terms of Arctic science. Now, the basic argument for this in a nutshell is that we're strongly warming up the Arctic. Absolutely, we're strongly warming it up. But that by strongly warming up the Arctic, we influence the jet stream patterns. And if we influence the jet stream patterns, that can influence weather conditions well outside of the Arctic. And so we have a strongly warming Arctic, but at the same time, that helps to contribute to things like, you know, the slew of nor'easters and things like this. It's a hard sell for some, of course. But it's a very controversial topic. There's some people like Jennifer Francis and Judah, I know them well, I've worked with them, who are very much on the side that we're seeing these things. There's other scientists who are saying, I'm not so sure about this. So it's a classic science debate, and at some point it will be resolved, but it's certainly probably one of the hottest topics out there right now.
Here's another hot topic. A group of scientists and information activists are ringing alarm bells about rising Arctic methane. Mark Cerise, do you think methane from the Arctic will have an important role to play in Earth's developing climate?
It's not clear. One of the things that some of the work we're doing right here at our center focuses on this thing called the carbon cycle feedback, and it involves permafrost on land, what a lot of the work we do here on. And the issue here is that if you look across the Arctic landscape on land, there's a whole lot of carbon locked up in these permafrost soils, old peatlands and things like that. But as the climate warms, that permafrost starts to thaw, and then the little critters in the soil become active. Respiration ensues, and what do they breathe out? Carbon dioxide and methane, depending on the situation. And there's questions out there about how big that carbon cycle feedback is, when will it kick in, but it's one of the things that people are looking at. Now, there's a whole other issue out here involving methane. And that is that underneath these big continental shelves over the Arctic Ocean, there's a lot of methane trapped in what they call a clathrate form. It's basically an ice that burns. Under certain pressure and temperature conditions, methane can actually exist as this in this icy state. And it's down there in the sediments down at the bottom of the ocean. And the concern is that we warm up the Arctic and we warm up the ocean and the sediments underneath, we could have a big release of methane from these methane clathrates. My view on this is that that is kind of a wild card out there and probably a low probability event. The thing that seems more likely is what's happening over land. But the Arctic has been full of surprises, and so it's not the sort of thing you want to entirely rule out.
Let's talk about storms in polar regions. Your research published with Alex Crawford last year on cyclones. I'm wondering if we continue on our strong current emissions path, you know, the 8.5, will there be more and stronger storms in the Arctic in coming decades? And if so, does that change the dynamics of sea ice?
Well, again, it's one of these things that we wish we had all the answers to and that we're really working hard on. Yeah, I've done a lot of work with Alex and others on these storms that we see in the Arctic. And especially over the past several summers, we've seen some humdingers out there in summer, these very, very deep, very, very strong storms out there. Will we see more of those in coming years? There's reason to think that we might, because one of the things that's happening is there's more water vapor in the atmosphere in the Arctic now. And water vapor can help feed these sorts of storms. We might see shifts also in the patterns of the storms. Work that I was doing with Alex was dealing with something called the Arctic frontal zone and how that forms. And that's probably going to change in the future as the climate warms up. So we know a lot about what's going on up there, but there's a lot that we still don't quite have a handle on. And those are the sorts of things that probably worry me more than the things we already know. You know, what are the unknowns out there?
But don't we need those storms to actually drive the sea ice out of the polar sea and get those records like we saw in 2007? I mean, it's more than just rapid heating in the Arctic that's destroying sea ice, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, it's actually a pretty complex thing. Now, if we look at what the Arctic does, okay, the sea ice waxes and wanes with the season. It grows through the autumn and the winter. And then it shrinks through the spring and summer as the Arctic warms up. And so then you have this minimum sea ice extent in September. Well, what you've seen now is less ice grows in the winter and more of it melts in the summer. And that is certainly a response to an overall warming Arctic. But if you look at these trends, there's these downward trends in sea ice extent. Superimposed on those trends are all these ups and downs and ups and downs. And those are related to the weather conditions. We know that there's certain patterns, like having a persistent high-pressure cell over the Arctic Ocean in summer, helps to get rid of the sea ice, not just that it melts more, but that it moves the ice around in such a way that it shunts more of it out of the Arctic Ocean where it can melt. So that gets at what you're talking about. You can have summers where it's a more stormy pattern, low pressure over the central Arctic Ocean. That's the thing that tends to preserve ice. But what we're seeing now is very clear evidence that the response of the ice to these weather systems is changing. And that's because as the ice starts to thin, and it's been thinning, its very response to these weather patterns also changes. So it's kind of a moving target.
And when it comes to predicting sea ice retreat, even experts have been fooled. No doubt you say in your coming book, Brave New Arctic, that everybody was surprised by the 2007 meltback. Have we improved our confidence in predicting sea ice levels since then?
Yeah, we have improved quite a bit in predicting these sea ice levels. Actually, there's a big project out there called the Sea Ice Prediction Network, the SIPN. And this is kind of a community grassroots effort in the science community to bring to bear all our different tools to see how well can we predict sea ice conditions. In other words, if we're in June, how well can we predict what's going to happen several months later in September for the total sea ice extent? Or, which is more important for anyone doing work up there, say, if you're trying to bring a tourist ship through there or something, it's the regional stuff, like when is the Chukchi Sea north of Alaska, when is that going to be opening up? And I think we've made some very strong progress on that. We're better than we used to be on it, but it's a tough thing to do. One of the things you really need to do well, if you're going to do this, is predict what the weather conditions are actually going to be. And just like in middle latitudes, right, we have problems in predicting weather. And so there are some real challenges out there, but I think we're doing a heck of a lot better than we used to.
So if I'm running a merchant ship and I want to go that Arctic route, there's still some uncertainty, you know, if I'm planning this 2 months in advance, just when I should do it.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing. Even though the Arctic is losing its ice cover is still a highly variable thing. So you probably know the last two summers, the Crystal Serenity, you know, went through the Northwest Passage with its boatload of moneyed tourists. And 2 years ago, they got through without a hitch. This year, this last summer, they got through, but they actually needed an icebreaker escort because the sea ice conditions are so highly variable. This is really one of the things that is still kind of limiting what the shipping companies are thinking in terms of using the Arctic as a shortcut. You know, they want to know with a pretty low risk what the sea ice conditions are going to be. And certainly we can help them in that sense. But there's still a lot of unpredictability out there. It really boils down to what these weather patterns are going to be. And we know we have a hard enough time predicting weather even in the middle latitudes beyond, say, 7 to 10 days. Same thing is happening up there.
Mark Cerise, is it possible to project in what year or even in what decade the Arctic will be mostly ice-free, say, except for, you know, some ice around the Canadian archipelago and a few other pockets? Do we know when that could happen?
We're starting to converge on the number there. Now, I've been on record saying that it could be as early as 2030, and I'll stand behind that. I'll be retired by then, maybe. But I've been on record saying that. Maybe that's a little aggressive, but throughout the community, I'd say that we're starting to see some gelling around a consensus of sometime in the 2040s. Could be earlier, could be later, but we're still talking, you know, a few decades from now. And that estimate, it's based on a lot of different things. What are the climate models telling us? Right? What do we think the future rates of greenhouse gas growth are going to be? They don't seem to show much of a chance of slowing down right now. What do the actual, you know, recent trends look like? What's the sea ice thickness doing? We look at a lot of these different things. And it looks like somewhere in the 2040s, but maybe my more aggressive scenario of, say, 2030 will end up being right. We'll see.
As you say, the Arctic is full of surprises. Is there a way to stop the loss of Arctic sea ice? What do you think about geoengineering, like tossing sulfate particles into the polar skies to deflect sunlight?
Yeah, okay. So if we could cool down the climate, let's say, the sea ice would recover, and it would actually recover probably pretty quickly. It might recover in a decade or something like that. But how do you cool the climate down? You know, our efforts so far to curb greenhouse gas growth have not been all that great, certainly here in the United States, although interestingly, fracking has actually helped in that, kind of ironic. But this idea of, you know, geoengineering, putting sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere, my view, my personal view is this is a fool's game. Because you're not really solving the problem. You're putting kind of a Band-Aid on it. And unless you take aggressive steps to reduce greenhouse gas growth, you're just putting a Band-Aid on it. And the other thing is, and the thing I always keep coming back to, is unintended consequences. You try to cool down the climate somehow by putting aerosols in the atmosphere, and you cause an immense drought in Africa or something like that. We're already tweaking this dial strongly that says, climate change on it. And so now are we going to tweak this one that says geoengineering? Boy, I hope we can come up with better solutions before we have to try that one.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Mark Cerise, the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. As you know, scientists like James Hansen are very concerned about the altered Earth energy balance, and that can happen when reflective sea ice changes into a darker ocean surface and absorbs the sun's heat. What do we know, and how serious is the energy imbalance when the Arctic sea ice retreats or when we get less reflective snow cover on land?
Well, yeah, both are contributing. These are part of what we call feedback cycles, of course. Is that the idea of this is that we warm up the climate a bit by carbon dioxide or any other mechanism for that matter, and then we melt some of that bright and reflective snow and ice cover, which means the surface now absorbs more of the sun's energy because it's less reflective, and that exacerbates the warming. And we've known for a long time that this feedback, we call albedo feedback, albedo is just a fancy name for the reflectivity of the surface. We've long known that this is a pretty powerful thing, a process going on in the climate system. And this is just what we're seeing now. We're seeing that the Arctic is losing its ice cover. It absorbs more of the solar energy. We see that in hastening the warming of the Arctic. And now we're starting to really see that in the snow cover, too. We're really seeing reductions in the spring snow cover. And that's important because it's spring when the solar radiation, the solar energy to the system is really increasing. Again, this variability from year to year in this thing, but we've long known that this albedo feedback is an important climate process, and we're seeing it unfold before our very eyes.
I've been covering this for years, and I have to say that the whole story of the land snow cover seems to be underestimated in the media and in public discussions.
Yeah, I would say it is. People are starting to see that now. There's more attention being drawn to it now. Similar is in terms of the Arctic sea ice extent. Everyone focuses on that September minimum extent. Is it going to be a new record, right? How low will it get? Well, what was happening at the end of winter, that sea ice maximum, has been relatively, we just kind of pass by year after year. But that's no longer the case, right? People are talking about what happens in winter. And the same thing now, we're seeing more and more attention being paid to what happens over land, not just in terms of the snow cover, but in things like how the permafrost is warming. And as I mentioned, this permafrost warming is a big issue because of all that carbon that's locked up on those frozen soils.
Why does the Arctic heat so much more when we're producing the greenhouse gases further south?
Yeah, well, it part and parcel, it's these feedback effects that I talked about in that we ask, well, where is the white snow and ice cover? It's in the Arctic. It's in the Antarctic as well, of course. But the Arctic is really sensitive to this because the Arctic is much warmer than the Antarctic. So if you warm up the Arctic a few degrees, it really matters because then you greatly lengthen the melt season and things like that. So part of this is because of these feedbacks. There's other things going on as well. Changes in cloud cover in the Arctic appear to be important. There's some very good, interesting work going on there that as we lose the sea ice cover, we actually change the cloud cover, and the change in cloud cover can exacerbate the warming. This whole Arctic amplification thing, this outsized warming of the Arctic, it actually is a pretty complex beast, and we're still trying to catch up with it.
Do you think that we've reached a tipping point where the ice on Greenland will melt almost no matter what happens over the next hundreds of years or even thousands of years? Have we reached that point?
I don't know if we have. There's been a lot of talk about these sort of tipping points. Tipping points in the sea ice cover, for example, if you thin it down to some critical level or you pass some critical threshold of greenhouse gas levels, that there's some point of no return and it will, suddenly quickly disappear. I've heard of similar things for Greenland. I'm not a great fan anymore myself of this tipping point argument. I've looked at it mostly from the sea ice point. What I see really happening in the Arctic is that we're going to really just continue on that trend that we've been going in, a warming Arctic, losing the sea ice cover, Greenland contributing to sea level rise. It's going to continue, and I suspect some of this is going to accelerate because of feedbacks and things like that. But I'd say I've backed off personally a little bit on this tipping point argument.
All right. Now, there's also a concern about sea ice that is normally thick and strong north of Greenland, and that gave way to open seawater in February of 2018.
Well, that's right. That's right. And, a shift in the winds will do that. You know, it'll form these polynyas and things like that. As I say, typically north of Greenland or the Canadian Arctic archipelago, you have the winds kind of push the ice against the coast a bit, and you pile it up and make it thick. But a shift in that could certainly open up these, a big polynya or something like that. Polynya is just it's a Russian word for a hole in the ice, basically.
Well, we know a large pool of colder meltwater has formed in the Atlantic south of Greenland. It's one of the few places on Earth that's getting colder in a warming world, and some scientists suggest that pool of ocean cooling could change the weather in the UK and northern Europe. Do you think meltwater in the oceans could throw us some unpleasant surprises?
It could, but it's a lot harder to do now than it was, say, back in the last glacial cycle. What we saw during the last glacial cycle was these things called Dansgaard-Oeschger events. And what they were these periods when we had this extremely rapid warming, and then it was followed by a longer period of cooling. And this happened again and again and again through that last glacial cycle. I'm talking about, 100,000, 50,000 years ago, and to about maybe 15,000 years ago, something like that. And what was going on there, apparently, was that there were these pulses of fresh water coming from like the big ice sheets that were dumped into the northern North Atlantic. And what these did was cap what we call the deep water production in the North Atlantic. What happens is the water moves north with the Gulf Stream, and it cools to the atmosphere, keeping Europe warm, and then it dives down to a great depth and returns south to lower latitudes. Well, the argument was that this was somehow cut off when we put a bunch of fresh water on the top. And we saw these things. We see these things in the Greenland record, the Greenland Ice Core record. Now, what's happening now? We have this area over the northern North Atlantic, which is staying fairly cool. Part of it is because we're warming the upper ocean. Part of it may be that there's more net precipitation or more fresh water coming in. So we could see something like that. I think, though, it's a whole lot harder right now to really get something catastrophic going on up there because compared to, say, where we were, 30,000 years ago, we've just got the Greenland ice sheet now, not this huge Laurentide ice sheet. It's a wussy little thing compared to what we have. But again, it's something to be watching for.
Does the National Snow and Ice Data Center also keep watch over sea ice and glaciers in Antarctica?
Oh, very much so, very much so. And still an ongoing puzzle, in part, is why Antarctica is behaving so much differently than the Arctic. Now, for some time, what we were seeing in the sea ice cover of the Arctic is that on an annual average, anyhow, for the Arctic as a whole, it was actually increasing slightly, but highly variable from year to year. And now, suddenly, over the past few years, we've had these record lows coming on. We had a bunch of record highs and a bunch of record lows going on. Crazy stuff we've been seeing. Now, if you look at what the climate models are telling us, they're telling us that Antarctica will be much slower to respond to climate change than the Arctic, and that's basically exactly what we've seen. But what it looks like now is that the Antarctic is, well, you can describe it maybe as a sleeping elephant that is now beginning to stir. Antarctic ice sheet is losing mass, contributing to sea level. The sea ice is doing some crazy stuff. It's these big changes going on. And again, we wish we had a better handle on that, but we don't. We don't have all the answers, and that's the fact about science. We just don't have all the answers yet.
Mark Cerise, you have a new book coming out in April from Princeton University Press. What is the title and what is it about?
Yeah, well, the book is called Brave New Arctic, The Untold Story of the Melting North. I didn't actually choose that title. I thought it was a bit Aldous Huxley-ish, Brave New World. But in any case, it is coming out pretty soon. I think it's released on April 18th. By Princeton University Press, and it's really a popular science book. It's a story about the changing Arctic, really told in large part from my personal perspective of someone who was there at the beginning. I mean, I was remember going back to the Arctic first time back in 1982, when it was the Arctic of old. But it's a story of how the Arctic changed and how we began to understand the change, how we were confused and debating what was happening when the first signs of the Arctic was stirring came out, like in the early 1990s, and how we slowly began to understand what was happening to the Arctic. So it's a book about the science. It's a detective story is what it really is.
You know, I was thinking about your book and the history of climate science, and I think that it might contain a lot of landing spots where some Americans and Europeans are still stuck. I mean, some people claim to believe the world is about to cool rapidly, and there was some talk about that back in the 70s. And many still doubt that human activities are to blame, so now maybe you're in the early 90s. So talk to us about your own transition from, you know, cooling to calling out the dangers of our emissions.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually another big part of the book is how my own views on this changed. Now, I went first to the Arctic first in 1982 as a young grad student, just had gotten my bachelor's degree, and I went up there for the first time. And not a lot of people were talking about climate change. And in fact, yeah, there was some talk that was in the late 1970s that we could be entering a cooling phase. And I actually kind of liked that idea. I came from coastal Maine and where we had real winters, and I liked snow and ice, right? But then we started to see the Arctic change. But I wasn't convinced that we were seeing a human effect, because what I was really starting to see as a scientist was how variable the Arctic was, just from the natural variability in the system, the changes from year to year, the influence of things like volcanic eruptions like Mount Pinatubo. Even, I would say, you know, in the 1990s, I was very well aware of what the climate models were projecting, that we should be warming up. To me, it was never a question of whether we would see the Arctic start to warm up through our own activities. It was really a question of, had we seen the change yet? And I hadn't been convinced. I was very much a fence-sitter on this issue. Even as early as the year 2000, I was still a fence-sitter. I had a very widely cited paper that came out about then, which basically said, yeah, the Arctic is changing, but attributing this to human activities, it's not clear. And it was probably sometime around 2002, 2003, a few years after that, that I kind of had that epiphany, right? That the amount of evidence, the level of evidence just became so overwhelming at that point that I said, okay, it's here now. So, you know, I came from kind of that skeptic's point of view until fairly recently, but, you know, that's how we kind of think as scientists sometimes. You know, you got to show me. You got to show me the evidence. And it took a while, but that we got there eventually.
Is it fair to say you have a careful mind?
I think I have a careful mind. I like to think of things logically. I like to think through the facts. I like to base my arguments on the physics. That doesn't mean that I don't play hunches and things like that, and certainly my emotions show at times, but I like to think of myself as a very careful scientist, and I see my role now increasingly as getting the word out in terms of what we actually see happening, right? Now, some people have even accused me of being more sensationalist now. Well, I don't think I am. I try to be measured, but, I mean, there's no doubt what is happening right now. I avoid cliches like the plague, but the Arctic has long been seen as that canary in the coal mine. That's where we'd see things happen. That's where we'd see things happen first. That is exactly what has happened.
From the University of Colorado in Boulder, we've been talking with the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center, Professor Mark Cerys. Next month, you can look for his new book, Brave New Arctic, The Untold Story of the Melting North. I'll put links to Mark and his work in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you for talking with us, and thank you for watching out over the poles.
Oh, well, I thank you for the interview, and yeah, we've got some exciting times ahead of us, I think.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.